From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection for this hour is made in a monthly rent check. How much are you paying for housing? In the past month, Democrats with presidential aspirations have taken aim at what they call the housing crisis and the rent crisis. The plan getting the most play is from California Senator Kamala Harris. Her bill is called the Rent Relief Act. Harris recently offered the following background for her proposal. First, she says, in 99% of counties in America, a person working a full-time job at minimum wage cannot afford to rent a one-bedroom apartment. Second, the Rent Relief Act says that if you spend more than 30% of your income on rent and utilities, you will get a portion of that money back. Senator Harris says the plan would give tens of billions of dollars in tax credits to approximately 20 million rent-burdened American households. Her bill would give renters what homeowners with mortgages have long enjoyed, a tax credit based on the value of their home. If it sounds straightforward, it's really not. There's been quite a lot of criticism, much of it coming from the progressive side of policy analysis. Henry Graber wrote a piece for Slate magazine titled, "These senators want to lower your rent. Too bad the plans won't work." He writes, quote, "Just as deductions for mortgage interest and local property taxes drive up home prices, a tax credit for high rents might prop up high rents. If the federal government agrees to cover all your rent payments in excess of $600 a month, why wouldn't you rent a $1,800 a month apartment? Or more worryingly, why wouldn't your landlord immediately raise your rent to $1,800 to take advantage of a federal subsidy?" End quote. Now, Senator Harris, her office says they've got protections built into the bill to deal with that. But Graber says they're ineffective. So what do other analysts think? And what would be effective in making renting more affordable for more Americans? Our guests this hour come from varying perspectives. Kent Gardner is the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Also with us is Pete Nabosny, an early childhood policy director for the Children's Agenda. Thank you, Pete. Nice to have you back here.
Good to be here.
And Stuart Mitchell is president and CEO of Pathstone Corporation. Stuart, welcome back to the program. So this is a home run, right, Kent? Senator Harris says, get ready to have a lot more money in your pocket, America.
Well, as the article you quoted suggests, this just has all kinds of kind of fundamental problems. I mean, I think the connection to the mortgage interest deduction is kind of an appropriate place to start. I don't know any economists, urban planners, anyone on the planet who pays attention to policy who thinks the mortgage interest deduction wasn't an enormous mistake. We've been trying to kill that thing off for a long time, and instead of killing Frankenstein, we're going to create the bride of Frankenstein. So there are many, many ways in which this distorts housing markets in ways that won't actually help a lot of the people that we'd like to help. Now, that's not to say that we need to be doing something about rents, but probably this is not the thing we should be doing.
Okay. Pete Nabosny, why is Senator Harris misguided with this then? She seems to be convinced that this is pretty simple and it will help millions of American households.
Well, I think it's important to kind of take a step back and recognize, obviously, there's an enormous rental housing kind of crisis in this country, and it's different in different parts of the country. And I think that the idea she's putting forth, you know, as someone who represents California, which has a real housing crunch, she's looking at it from the perspective that, we have to do something about rental prices, and things like Section 8, programs like that don't necessarily address kind of the middle class
Let me interrupt you for 1 second, Peter. Stuart, just do me a favor and come move to mic 4 because we're having a technological issue here. We get no tax credits for the microphones in the studio, and occasionally we need to replace them ourselves. Go ahead, Pete.
Sure. So I was saying, I think this is coming from a place of trying to do something for a broad set of Americans who are really struggling to pay rent, and we have a lot of housing instability, and our traditional programs like Section 8 don't really fit with this current challenge for a lot of people, and we're not building public housing anymore, and we're underinvesting in affordable housing in general. And so this is one approach to try to tackle this, but unfortunately, it seems to me, and when you start kind of walking through the scenarios and doing the math on this and everything else, this would ultimately result in much more expensive rental housing for anyone who's kind of participating in the rental market, and therefore it ends up almost being a subsidy to landlords, and that's
because they can just jack prices. They really could do that, huh?
Well, so if you think
no, we'll have rules that will make that illegal, Evan. Please,
you don't seem to believe that will be very effective, Kent. Pete.
No, I don't think so. I was, again, before the show here, I was sort of doing some math on this, and math's kind of hard on the radio, but someone making $30,000 a year in this community who pays $900 a month in rent, they would get a pretty substantial return on their taxes from this plan. They get a $1,350 credit, which would...
All right, so hold on. Let's do this again here, because sure. you're talking about in Rochester.
Yeah.
And this matters because the senator's plan is meant to be different in San Francisco, in Cleveland, in Rochester, I think, right?
Well, yeah. So it's the amount that it goes up to cover rents is based on the fair market value within a particular community, which is regionally specific. We have lower cost rents here
sure.
than they do in the Bay Area.
All right. So what Pete is talking about is you're making $30,000 a year in Rochester. Your rent is $900 a month, and you get how much back as a credit?
That person would get a $1,350 credit for the year. So that's a pretty substantial, pretty substantial amount for the year. It's more than a month's rent, and you know that would support them. The tax system's a little funky to do this through. Most people who are struggling to pay their rent are struggling on a month-to-month basis, so a one-time-a-year tax credit may not actually improve housing stability that much, but it would give them some additional resources. But that person is probably going to look at it like, well, hey, if I'm getting this credit back for this amount, maybe I'll get a $1,000 a month apartment because it's a better apartment, and they know that the credit would also rise as they pay more in rent. And so that person would, for each $100 increase of rent per month, they're only paying about $25 of it, and the federal government would cover the other $75. So that's a good deal for them. But as I think the article lays out, landlords would recognize this too, and they would, you know, increase rents for the $900 apartment is all of a sudden listed at $1,000 or at $1,100, and it just creates sort of this escalation of rent prices that that really isn't ultimately helpful because the quality of the housing and the total rent burden for that person ends up just kind of rising as the credit covers more of the cost.
Okay, so that's a good outline of Kent and Pete's concerns. Stuart, do you have any different views on this, or how do you feel about the senator's plan?
I would come at it from the perspective of Matthew Desmond's overall concern related to housing instability and the impact of evictions on families' lives, and that conversation around modalities for finding solutions to that ought to include a conversation like we're having today, because there's got to be some way of addressing housing instability driven by this issue of people spending way more than 30% of their income toward housing. So that if the model being discussed isn't the right one, then what are some better ones that are out there that would address the issues that Pete brings up, but also actually begin to shift some of those resources? The mortgage interest deduction is like motherhood and apple pie. Is this, you know, the people who get that believe that that's a privilege. I mean, that's a right, not a privilege. It belongs to them because they own a house. Supposing we could divert, I think, Pete, you said it's $100 billion a year that we now spend as a country on the mortgage interest deduction. If we diverted half of that to some program that benefited renters, that would be a redistribution of resources in a place where families who are in that rental capacity of being overburdened would begin to find some relief.
You know, Stuart, this conversation about mortgage interest deduction is interesting because you talk about the $40 billion, but you don't remember that's $40 billion that we have agreed not to receive. So it's not like there's this money sitting in the federal budget that we could say, oh, we're going to spend it. Instead of spending it here, we're going to spend it over here, because it's money we chose not to collect. And that's the other problem with public policy by tax credit, by agreeing not to receive something that you otherwise mm-hmm. would receive. Once again, it's extraordinarily difficult to back away from that because, you know, it doesn't have any impact on the federal budget, right?
Is this why economists generally hate tax credits, Kent? Are they inefficient?
Well, tax credits are not inefficient, but yes, in some cases they can certainly be inefficient, but they're hidden is the problem. And, you know, if Congress has to actually fund something, then they're making a much more conscious decision. And that's one of the things for Senator Harris. Senator Harris can say, well, this is just going to be a credit, and no one has to appropriate any money for it. Now, there are ways of changing how you do budgeting, But we account for money that we've chosen not to receive. It's called a tax expenditure. But you don't actually have to appropriate the money to fund the program. You just agree you're not going to get the money.
Okay. And at least I think what I'm hearing from Stuart is satisfaction is the wrong word. At least maybe something positive along the lines of, well, finally we're talking about this. And that even if these proposals that we're talking about today aren't all that serious, do you think the conversation at least is going to take a few incremental steps forward because of it?
I'm hoping that it has the impact that we're talking about it today, that we have a way of thinking about the housing insecurity slash evictions or disrupting families' lives. That's a huge and growing problem in our area and across the country. And that has something to do with the mismatch between the cost of renting in a decent, safe apartment and the income. We, you know, whether I appreciate Ken's point, it's not income that the government can realign, but it is lost income that's sitting out there benefiting people like us who own homes that is not available to benefit people who are renting.
Okay. Let me also just say to our audience, because we're going to talk not just about maybe what our guests see as possible pitfalls with these proposals, but what might work. And if you want to share your story on rent, on what you're paying, if you get questions and maybe on how these kinds of proposals would impact you, has your rent gone up? Do you find – I'm always curious to know what people think about Rochester and the Finger Lakes region as – an affordable or not place to live. And some of that's perspective. Some of that is simply, I mean, I talked to a local business owner who came from New York City 2 months ago and said, it just feels like I'm in a different world. But that's not certainly not the case for everybody. 844-295-TALK, if you want to call the program, it's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling in Rochester. 263-9994. Senator Cory Booker, who is also possibly going to run, to put forth a kind of similar proposal, but aimed a little bit more, without being firm about it, on increasing housing stock. And let me also read, before I get our guests to respond to that, from this piece from Henry Graeber in Slate, where he writes the following: housing prices don't fall until we build more homes. Unfortunately, requirements that suburbs allow new housing were written into the Fair Housing Act in 1968. As Nixon's HUD Secretary George Romney put it in 1970, suburbs must be open to all, but they have remained totally unenforced ever since. End quote. Pete, do you agree with that? Is housing stock a big part of this question?
Yes. I mean, and certainly in other parts of the country, there's enormous pressure and a lot of sort of discord in those communities between neighborhoods that have single family homes and a lot of people who are trying to upzone those areas so they can build, you know, apartment buildings and kind of create better density to increase the supply of housing. In Rochester, we have it's a bit different. As you were saying, you know, we sort of have a reputation for being an affordable place to live, and housing prices are considerably lower here than elsewhere. But we do have a similar dynamic here. We have suburbs that are primarily single family homes that are zoned that way. You can't build a lot of multifamily housing there. And that has the effect of segregating our society, both along racial lines and income lines, because race and income are so closely tied here. And so we have an enormous problem with socioeconomic and racial diversity in this community. And a lot of that does come down to issues of zoning and how towns have made decisions about how they want to structure the housing in their community and who that leaves out, which is often folks who can't afford to purchase a single family home in that community there.
Okay, Kent?
But Pete, I mean, there's that multifamily development in Pittsford along the canal, right? That's multifamily in it. Oh, right. That one's been caught up in litigation for how long now? What share of the village budget in Pittsford is devoted to fighting a multifamily development in bucolic Pittsford? I mean, it's, you know, exclusionary zoning has made it very, very difficult to have multifamily located outside of the city of Rochester. Vast majority of multifamily I don't know what the numbers are, we could pull them out, is in the city of Rochester. And for that reason, I believe that landlords are actually able to charge relatively higher rents. So while housing prices in general are lower in Rochester, I believe that the statistics suggest that rental prices are relatively higher, affordable rental prices are relatively higher in Rochester. So so that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem, when you think about this from Senator Harris's perspective, and she comes from the land, the grand land of exclusionary zoning. Folks in California are really, really good at preserving the lovely nature of the single-family homes in San Francisco. If you've been to San Francisco, there's some lovely neighborhoods in San Francisco that are all single-family. You've got tremendous pressure on housing, and yet talk about taking down some of those single-family homes and building multifamily on those same parcels, and you run into a firestorm. There's this new, which I love, there's this new movement, the YIMBY movement. Yes, in my backyard, because I mean, fundamentally, this is a. I'm an economist. This, economists of joke about an economist is economists just learn how you could teach a parrot to be a great economist just by saying supply and demand, and we've got way too little supply of housing in general, and because we've got too little housing, we're going to have really high rents. If we took away some of those restrictions on housing development, we would see more supply naturally occurring, and that would drive down rents.
Short answer, because I know Stuart wants to weigh in, and then I got to get Beatrice's phone call. Who's mostly in charge with changing those zoning rules, Kent? Who has the power?
Yeah, every local government in America.
It's local municipalities, right?
That's right.
Okay. So you're going to call Pittsford. Let them know what you think.
I think it's a wonderful case study. It really is.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I mean, because we know that apartment project that Mark IV has been attempting to build in Pittsford is not going to be affordable housing. There's probably a portion there, but this is going to be pretty high-end rental housing.
Okay.
So,
Stuart, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
I just comment that we in the affordable housing development business have probably put, over the last 20 years, I would say 90 to 95% of the affordable housing that's been developed in the center neighborhoods of Rochester, with very, very few multifamily properties in the suburbs. And you can lay it to exclusionary zoning, you can lay it to the racism, you can lay it to all kinds of issues, but the fact is, we are continuing to invest federal dollars and state dollars in disinvested communities and creating even more segregation because of the way in which we have not been able to access affordable housing in the suburbs. So it's a huge issue, and I think it's one that requires immediate attention. If we have a chance, I'll describe the RMAPE strategy around that that came out as recommendations from RMAPE that, frankly, haven't gone anywhere yet, but I think could go somewhere.
Well, sure, and I think Senator Harris would simply say, if she were in the room, there are certain things that the federal government and I and my power as a senator could do and maybe could not do, and if Kent is right on municipalities having most of the power to say yes or no, and if Henry Graeber's piece in Slate illustrates the point that since the 1970s, these rules about housing have been largely unenforced, does that suggest there is more power at the federal level to flex a little muscle on that, or is it still going to be in the hands of local government?
I think the federal government has demonstrated a willingness to flex its muscles on many, many issues. I don't see it likely that they're going to flex their muscles on this one. I mean, you think about raising the drinking age to 21. The Fed said, to the states, you can have any drinking age you want, but if it's not 21, forget those federal highway funds. So there are ways to threaten control.
Okay. Let me get Beatrice's question. She's calling from Webster. Go ahead, Beatrice.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just want to ask a question, please. Why are landlords allowed to hike the rent at will for these slum houses that they're renting to people to live in? Why are landlords allowed to hike the rent whenever they want to, whenever they feel like it, and the house already looks like where rats should be living? I went in a few houses, and I broke down crying. It was just awful. I think there should be a cap on rent. I think I don't want to take up more of my time. I don't want to lie. I just said I wanted to say what I said.
Okay.
And I want to get off the phone.
Okay. All right, Beatrice. Thank you. She's wanting to know why. Is there a short answer to this?
Well, it certainly is possible to put on price controls on rent, and you know we've seen price controls on rent in many cities, you know, most notably New York City, and it does create some real challenges. There are lots of workarounds. There are people who squat in those rent-controlled houses, those rent-controlled apartments for a very long time. There are a few congressmen who've been caught controlling several rent-controlled apartments in the New York City area. So, yes, it's possible. It's complicated, and it would have to have some of those same kind of controls that we've talked about that would be ushered in by this Rent Relief Act.
Okay, Stuart?
And I think there's a balance between the responsibilities of a good landlord taking responsibility for keeping his or her property in good shape and recognizing that we are in a market right now that makes it very difficult for any renter to have much negotiating power because of the cost differential. And so that they, combination of being a reputable and decent landlord certainly is an important component. And I think the local towns have a responsibility to find a way to enforce the regulations that are in those towns to ensure that the housing stock is kept up, and that's a governmental responsibility.
The term affordable housing, does it have any legal meaning, by the way? Affordable.
I don't think it does. It's a term that is used in our business, at least, when there's a subsidy of some kind involved.
I want to just give an example, and I don't mean to snark or cast aspersions at a project that's gotten a lot of press, but this is a genuine question that I had for Willie Lightfoot, who was on the program, Sandy Parker, defending the Parcel 5 project proposal a number of months ago now, earlier this year, insisting that, yes, of those 150 housing units, it would be mixed housing with some affordable housing. What does affordable mean
in that context,
in a tower like that?
In that context, it means that there is going to be some type of state tax credit investment.
So it's going to be subsidized.
Subsidized so that it will drive the cost of those units to a more affordable level.
For the person paying, but okay.
The person paying. Sure. So you may be at 80% of AMI and you pay a certain amount. You'd be at 50%, you pay another amount. 30%, you do. So in our business, the issue is creating a mix of those ranges of affordability so that we can have a range of income people with different varying incomes in those properties.
But Stuart, let's say I build a tower with 150 units, or let's just say it's got 100 units, and I tell the community this is going to be mixed housing, and there will be some affordable housing, and there's two units that are subsidized mm-hmm. for affordable housing, and there's 98 higher-end, more luxury units. Can I then justifiably call mixed housing?
Well, you could call those, if you are, you would not get a state tax credit program to fund two units. That wouldn't happen, but you might personally, you know, as a corporate developer, you might decide to personally, as an organization, subsidize two units because you think that that's a good thing to do. But the only part of that would be
out of the
affordable
goodness of your heart, or because you could tell the community, no, this is mixed housing.
It is mixed housing. It's got two units of affordable. The question would come up, and you'd have to say, I've got two units.
Okay,
so, Stuart, typically there's like a 80-20 ratio to a lot of these developments, right? 80% of the housing is market rate and 20% is affordable, just to put some kind of context.
That's one program.
There's a bunch of different models,
right.
It's not two of 100, but it's often some mix between market rate and tax credit or affordable in order to receive those tax credits to help support the development.
Okay,
of the
so
Brighton requires a mix. We could get into what Brighton requires for affordable developers, for market rate developers.
I've got a small pile of emails. Before I get to that, I'll tell the audience again, if you want to join the conversation as we talk about what would be effective in reducing the burden on renters when it comes to what we pay to live in this country in various places, Senator Kamala Harris, who's from California, and as Kent has pointed out, that is sort of ground zero for the challenge in affording where you live. She's put forth what she calls the Rent Relief Act to some derision or to some mocking is the wrong word, but to some I think opprobrium from the analysis community who feels like it wasn't really fully vetted, that there are some unintended consequences here. But we've got national aspirants talking about reducing the burden of rent. And if you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. You just heard Stuart Mitchell, President and CEO of Pathstone Corporation, Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda, Kent Gardner from CGR, the Center for Governmental Research. And before we get back to your emails and phone calls, let me just ask the panel. We've been talking about what doesn't work in these plans. Pete, give me you get to be in the room now with these presidential aspirants, and they say, okay, I guess I was misguided on a lot of this stuff, but Nabosny, give me step one. What does work to reduce the burden on renters?
Well, so there are a lot of things that we know work that we're not fully funding today. Housing choice vouchers, Section 8, is something that is considerably underfunded. There's waiting lists in every community in the country that has Section 8. And so we can increase funding for that program. When I was trying to think through this bill, I think given that we have this enormous mortgage interest deduction in this country that goes increasingly to wealthier folks and grows as people buy larger houses, I do think it would make some sense, given that context, to have a renter tax credit that's perhaps a flat credit. It's, if there's 40 million renters, we're spending, next year we'll spend $40 billion on the mortgage interest deduction. So that's a $1,000 credit for every rental household in the country that as a flat credit would avoid some of this 30% business that ends up being kind of distorting. But, ultimately, a lot of policies that go to increase the income or the earnings or the cash that people have, that's what pays the rent, right? And so we need to find ways to get ultimate money into people's pockets to be able to continue to stay in their housing or find new housing that's better suiting their needs.
Okay. Kent Gardner, what can work?
Well, again, I'm back to the housing supply question. I'd like to see I'd certainly like to see, that we carve away the, mortgage interest deduction. Again, we've been talking about that for a long time. We sliced a little teeny bit off of it in the tax act that was passed in the fall, so it's a little less generous.
Would that mean that you pay more? Are you willing to pay more?
You bet.
Is this a YIMBY situation?
It is.
Okay.
And, those of us who own homes should not be getting such a great deal. And again, the mortgage interest deduction has had a significant consequences in terms of urban sprawl, in terms of promoting home ownership over multifamily. There are a lot of things we could do. So just simply getting rid of that and as soon as we get rid of that, then we do create income for the government. So then we do have some money we can actually spend. So we get, we can harvest those tax credits by eliminating that over a period of time. And something graduated over a 10-year period, I think, and then put that money, again, I think, into subsidizing, probably bribing municipalities to lower the barriers to multifamily development, I guess, is where I would end up.
Okay. And Stuart, do you see?
Well, there's another direction. I don't think this has any legs either, but countries that make it possible for families to live in affordable homes their entire life. I mean, they call it in New York rent control, but in England it's a concept that is much different than what we think of as housing is a privilege versus housing is a right. If housing is a right, then the collective we, the government, helps figure out how to make it affordable for people for the whole range of income choices, so that conversation gets stopped, because we are using the tax, and that's where I understand what Kent's saying. We're using a tax credit program to develop affordable housing through the low-income housing tax credit, and the demand is just so much greater than the resources are that are available, that it's a misnomer to say that that is going to be a solution, because it probably isn't, unless they got a lot more tax credit money than they currently put out there. Only like 25% of eligible families across the country, and Desmond makes this point, even have access to any subsidy of any kind. So the most people are in the private market for housing, period. And so the dent that we make with tax credits is a hit and miss, and certainly important to spread those dollars out. I think getting those dollars into high-performing school districts, getting them into communities of opportunity, would be a really important step to take to begin to develop some diversity in the community. But though that is not going to be a housing policy, I don't think that will actually fundamentally make housing affordable. So,
well, is this a case where UBI should come into play as part of, I can't believe we've gone 30 minutes without Pete Nabosny bringing up universal basic income. Is that part of this discussion? Should it be?
Well, it would certainly help with some of this stuff, right? I mean, most of the UBI proposals, you know, it's not targeted towards housing. I mean, none of it's targeted towards housing,
right,
or transportation or whatever else. But the beauty of cash transfer programs is that it allows people who receive that funding to figure out what best meets their needs. And for a lot of folks, that is housing. You know, in Rochester, just I have the families making less than $35,000 in the city of Rochester, 85% of them are rent burdened, are paying more than 30% of their income towards rent. And so that's a considerable number. Once you get down to, you know, to lower income levels, essentially everyone is rent burdened in this community. And things like UBI, we've talked in the past about the earned income tax credit, some of these other ways to get additional resources into families' bank accounts, it does start to address some of these things. And I think more importantly, it leads to, families have more housing stability. Those kids are they do better in school. They have higher graduation rates. There's less trauma on the family from the fact that they're not being evicted. An eviction is an incredibly traumatic experience for a child and for an adult. And so, when we think about all these things together, finding ways to improve the financial stability of families through various means is really important to our overall quality of life and well-being as a community.
All right, I'm late for our only break. Let's take that break. We're going to come back to Joe on the phone. I've got more emails that we'll sort through as we work through your questions, not only about Senator Kamala Harris's Rent Relief Act, but about the questions on housing affordability in general and what proposals would and would not work. Let's get that break and come right back here on Connections. All right, welcome back to Connections. Let's get another phone call. This is Joe in Rochester next. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I just had a couple of comments. The first being about area median income. I just want to clarify for the listeners out there who may not be familiar with this term. Area median income is what the affordability of these properties, these tax credit developments, is based on. And the area median income is for the greater Rochester area. And why that's important is because median income for the greater Rochester area is much higher than it is in the city. So we're basing affordability on properties in the city that are actually affordable for a much higher income level. So when we talk about something that's 80% of AMI and we're labeling it as affordable, it's actually not really affordable for the overwhelming majority of people who need affordable housing in Rochester. So that's really important for people to understand, because we're doing a lot of these affordable housing developments and we're saying 80% AMI. 60% AMI, and people don't really understand what that term means. And until we do, we can't really have an honest conversation about what affordability really is and what affordable housing really is, because we really need to get those 50% AMI, those 30% AMI, and even lower. That's the housing that we really have a desperate need for in Rochester. I also want to say the second comment, the City Roofs Community Land Trust is an organization that I'm a part of. And what we work to do is to have the community residents actually determine what affordability is. We then subsidize either a homeownership opportunity or a rental property, and we make it permanently affordable. So it's a one-time subsidy, and we keep it affordable permanently. We remove the profit motive from the property, and we make it a community-controlled property, where, again, the community kind of controls what is affordable, what does the community need, and we move forward. So I would offer that as a potential solution, something that's been used in Albany, something they're using in Boston and Burlington, Vermont. Throughout the country, this is a growing movement.
All right, Joe, thank you. Some thoughts on that. Stuart,
I think,
go ahead.
I think the land trust is a great idea, and we're working with one in Newburgh. So, yeah, I think a land trust that locks down the cost for a duration beyond the current owner is a concept. Not everybody can live with that, because they would like to be able to think they're creating an asset in their lifetime that can be used in the terms of a family being able to pass this asset down. But there's other ways to think about how to create assets. But so the land trust, I think, is a good idea. I think the 80%, 60%, 50% argument is really important and it's really helpful. But from a developer who does developments using the low-income housing tax credit program, The trick is to figure out how to pay back the mortgages that have to be added onto the equity that comes from the tax credit, so that if we, the tax credits do not pay 100% of the cost of developing the property. It pays maybe 50% at most, so that we have to borrow or get grants for the other 50%. So the way you create a business model that is sustainable, you have to have enough people paying high enough rent to support the people who are not paying the high rents, and you got to put those together in a way in which the actual mortgage that you've got on the property can get paid back.
Let me just read a little bit of, and our thanks to Councilman Michael Patterson, who let us know about this, and Juan Vazquez, my colleague, just handed this to me. City Council in Rochester, at their upcoming meeting on the 21st of August, is going to try to redefine affordable housing. And Mayor Warren sent City Council this note on the subject of what is affordable. She writes, quote, "The charter currently defines low and moderate income individuals as those earning up to 120% of the AMI, area median income, which includes the incomes of those in the area of Monroe, Livingston, Ontario, Orleans, Wayne, and Yates counties. And according to HUD data, the MSA median income of a family of four is $74,000, while in the city alone, it is less than half of that. And the inclusion of non-city residents skews the median income upwards. The current wording of the charter allows housing that is affordable for a family earning $88,800 to be labeled affordable overall, despite the fact that it is not at all affordable to the third of Rochester families who spend greater than 50% of their total incomes on housing." And so she writes, "If Rochester is to focus on creating, preserving, and restoring housing that is actually affordable, it is necessary to have a more nuanced understanding of the city's target populations. And so the charter amendment will provide clarity through four definitions now. Moderate income will be 81 to 120% of AMI. Low income will be 51 to 80%. Very low, 31 to 50%, and extremely low, 0 to 30%. These definitions will inform city initiatives to improve affordable housing policies so they better serve those who are truly in need." That's from Mayor Warren to City Council. They're going to consider that on August 21st, and thanks to Councilman Patterson. What do you make of that, Pete Nabosny? Is there some good logic there?
Well, certainly. I mean, I certainly think we want to make sure that when we are talking about affordable housing and when we're building affordable housing, it's actually
affordable
to the people in that community. You know? Yeah. And so I think that's really helpful in clarifying. You know, I think to Stuart's point, the bottom line with all this, the math has to work in order for someone to build housing in general. And so the lower the percentage of the AMI, the less you're collecting in rent from those individuals. And so therefore, the greater the public subsidy has to be, whether it's through the tax credit system or through some other, you know, old-fashioned way of paying people money for a particular service. And so as we want to build more low-income housing for truly low-income people, we'll have to find ways to get more public dollars to support the development of that housing. It's just that's the basic math of building affordable housing anywhere. And so I think it's great, but it needs to be accompanied by more funding if we're going to build more housing for lower income folks.
Okay. Now let me just get to some of more of the listener emails on this subject. And Mark writes to the program and says, "Hi, Evan. I live with a roommate. Who's to say what percentage of the rent I'm actually paying? My roommate and I pay a landlord, but we each pay a portion. I'm not here to tell you what I'm paying, but do I have to tell the government under this new plan? What if I'm only paying 30% of the rent and my roommate is covering 70 and we're not doing 50-50? Do we have to fill out a verification form? Who is going to track that?" That's from Mark. So he's responding to Kamala Harris's idea on trying to determine who's paying what rent, et cetera. And I actually hadn't considered people who live with others splitting rent. Kent Gardner, what would you say to Mark?
Well, that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of regulatory management of something like this. And it does get back to Pete's point about universal basic income. The nice thing about universal basic income is that you don't have to have a 3,527-page set of regulations that govern the program. And that's really what we'd be walking into with this Rent Relief Act. It's just complicated. And, you know, it's not that we don't pass complicated laws, but I think it's incumbent upon Congress to think about whether something is actually can be practically implemented without hiring thousands and thousands of people who are writing regulations and enforcing regulations.
Are you saying it's a jobs creation bill?
It's a jobs creation bill. That's right. So, unfortunately, a lot of what we do in the public sector ends up being a jobs creation bill, right?
And this is where I think for listeners who hear universal basic income, which really merits its own fresh conversation sometime soon, because I'm seeing it come up almost daily now. But when it comes to UBI, when it comes to just giving people in poverty money directly, no strings attached, the interesting thing here is that generally conservatives are leery of that. They're worried that, well, what would you spend that money on? What if you spend it on something that I don't approve of? And to police the way money is spent requires more regulatory oversight, which requires more government employees, which requires more burdensome overall government, whereas the ostensible liberal or progressive program, which would be more efficient, which is just give people money, would require less, but has less or no limitations on how the money is spent. And I find that to be sort of an interesting flip on the paradigm.
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that conservatives split into two big camps. There's the social conservatives, and then there's libertarians. And libertarians would be all over this. Libertarians, absolutely. You know, it makes a lot of sense. Why should we tell people what they can do? Let's give them money. Let them spend it however they like. So I think you'd find a significant support among libertarians.
Unless libertarians would also say, why are we giving anybody any government money, ostensible quote-unquote government money?
Well, I think there is a piece of that, to be sure. But if you give a libertarian a choice of the crazy quilt collection of welfare support programs we have right now and basic income support program, they pick the basic income support program every day.
This is from Dave in Rochester. Dave says, I'm a big fan of placing more affordable housing in the suburbs, but just placing that there is only part of the solution. Without a solid transportation plan to support those families to get to their jobs, health care, and other services, such efforts may set the families up for failure. What do you think, Stuart?
I think it's a very legitimate point, and that there ought to be tied to that resource that's now becoming available exactly that. What kind of support systems need to be put in place that would then make it possible for someone who needs to get to a job? Lots of times they're going to be actually closer to the jobs than they are if they're in the city. So there may be easier ways to get around, but absolutely, families, whether it's in the suburbs or the cities, we have to continue to find ways to support people who are trying to find their way through this network of poverty that has been that they've been trapped in. So we've got to find vehicles for making that happen. And if I use an analogy often that we know lots of groups, mostly church groups, that are working with immigrant communities, helping them get resettled into Rochester. And we think that's a positive thing to do. And it is, absolutely. That same model could be used to help many families who are here in the city right now get help in accessing a good school, for example, where they need to get into a better school system. And we could help create the support systems that they could then use to make it successful. So there's models out there. I just don't think we have thought about how best to play those out, but opening up the suburbs to affordable housing is, to me, absolutely critical to this idea of creating pathways to opportunity and creating a pathway out of poverty.
Okay, Pete?
Sure. So there's a lot of land use and design issues that come into play with this. I don't think the proposal is let's plop a 100-unit affordable housing development at the end of a cul-de-sac that's buried within a suburban neighborhood. We do have areas in our suburbs, we have villages, we have areas with some density that you can build upon, that if you continue to, if we diversify our community in housing options throughout the entire community, you'd still do it with some element of clustering and urban design and things like that, that when we have those things in place, that does allow, bus routes to come through that area and to for people who are living there to be able to access, the broader regional economy, even if they don't have a car. It is a challenge. The city is, and as we're seeing with the whole reimagined RTS process, the city is really the one place in our region where you can, operate 40-foot buses at scale. And that's why a lot of the proposed route changes focus on the city. But But there's nothing inherent about the city other than it has a sufficient density and ridership and urban design that allows a public transportation system to work better here than it does, you know, in other parts of Monroe County. And so we have to be thoughtful about how we're designing these programs. And I think we are. You know, I think when affordable housing is built in non-center cities around the country, there is a thought towards, you know, transportation and access to services and schools and all these other things. And the fact that we haven't done a lot of that here makes it seem so foreign to people. But these are like fixable problems that we need to kind of work through.
We've done two properties in Gates with Marcassini's active support. And both of those properties are thriving. And those are both affordable. Those are, you know, we've created, I think, now a total of more than 100 units in those two properties, and there's demand for more. And I think someone with the leadership skills of a Marcassini working through his own political process in Gates was critical to making that happen. And now they can see a model example of integrated housing that is making a difference in the lives of many, many families, and certainly the communities that they live in, the schools they go to, and all the rest. So I think it can be done. It absolutely can be done. And if you look at the Gates example, that could be replicated in every suburb.
Kent Gardner, I've got an email from Sarah who says, why, and I don't think you're just the only snarler or snarker on the panel, but I'm going to start with you on this. She says, why are the snarling, snarky comments that are directed at landlords never directed at the government landlord? My home is paid off, but I still need $700, quote, rent in the name of property taxes. When I am old, I will be put out of my home when I can no longer afford the, quote, rent on the home that I've maintained and owned for decades. And I understand in New York State my monthly figure is on the low side. That's from Sarah.
Yes, well, that's an entirely new topic.
Yeah.
The question of why property taxes are high is complicated, and I think it's deeply embedded in how we manage public education. Certainly in New York State, education is the reason for, it's the first 10 reasons why property taxes are high. And of course, that has to do with how we fund public education as well. But it's a complicated topic. I understand the point. And our property taxes in New York State are significantly higher per dwelling unit as a function of median household income than in almost any other state in the nation.
Okay. Canandaigua, Christine writes from Canandaigua just to say, this entire conversation is difficult to have without tying this to a livable wage in American communities. Pete Nabosny?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And really what we're seeing with this rental housing crisis that we have in many parts of the country with in very different markets like Rochester compared to San Francisco, a lot of it ultimately still comes down to we've had stagnant wage growth in this country for years, many, many years.
Can I read a stat, by the way?
Nationwide
rents and incomes have diverged. According to the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies annual report, the median rent payment rose 61% between 1960 and 2016, while the median renter income grew only 5%.
Yeah, so I mean, and that's the story right there, right? If rents are rising and incomes aren't, then you're going to have an increasing problem with affordability. In Rochester, we have an enormous challenge with poverty. People who are in poverty don't have the funds to pay a market rate rent. Even if it is a lower rent, if you don't have much income, it's really hard to commit that to housing. And so a lot of this does tie into, you know, issues of economic inequality and of intense concentrated poverty. And that's the fundamental that's driving a lot of this. And when we talk about housing, that's a result of a lot of these other challenges that we have in this community.
Okay. Kent, you want to add to that?
Yeah, we've got two supply constraints. One is a supply of housing constraint, and then the other is a supply of good jobs constraint. And, just as the supply of housing constraint can't simply be fixed by Congress passing a law, that's the same thing that's true, I believe, for the supply of good jobs. There's a certain amount we can do with the the EITC, the tax credit, and there's also more we can do at some level with the minimum wage. But fundamentally, the economy has to work better for people who don't come in with a high skill level. And we need to be able to improve those skills and be able to compete in a global economy.
But this just shows you that Senator Harris's plan, we've already talked about UBI, we've talked about property taxes, Sarah wanted to bring up, livable wage, Christine brings up. So there's so many things at play here. And Kent, just the subject of whether we can force wages upward by increasing the minimum wage and whether there are deleterious effects there is its own conversation separately, too. I mean, if there were an easy solution here, I think we would have done it.
Well, maybe not, given the current leadership of the nation, but, one would hope.
Stuart, anything you want to add?
Would add that the conversation that's getting opened up would be greatly enriched if we looked at it through the lens of race, equity, diversity, and inclusion, so that if we had this idea that we could put together people across the spectrum, across our geography, and get at this idea of creating champions for diversity, champions for ways in which we could look at new issues or look at old issues in new ways, and try to open up a conversation that wasn't perceived to be one way or the other, or pointing fingers or accusing people of this or that, but simply trying to wrap their arms around this complex problem and open up a conversation, but include the city, include the suburbs, put everybody kind of in the mix and have a conversation about what would be the value of creating champions of diversity for our total community that would be committed to breaking down the segregation that now exists.
All right, so let's close with a quick question for Kent, only because there are times where Kent will be direct when he thinks a politician is being cynical. Do you think Senator Harris honestly believes the Rental Relief Act is a good idea, or do you think it's a cynical ploy for votes?
I do think the depth of cynicism among politicians is very difficult to underestimate. She's a smart lady. I would be kind of shocked if she didn't understand the limitations of the proposal.
Kent Gardner from CGR, always nice to have you. Thank you, Kent.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda. Thank you, Pete.
Thanks for having
me. Want to come back and talk UBI soon?
You bet.
Let's do that. And Stuart Mitchell, President and CEO of Pathstone Corporation. Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you.
More Connections coming up.